Morning, comrades. How are you doing? Okay. I just want to make sure that we're all there and that we're attentive, because what we're dealing with here, sisters and brothers, is a crisis in capitalism. What we're dealing with here is the oppression and exploitation of workers. This is not a new event. It's not something that happened recently. This is something that we've been battling since the Industrial Revolution. This is a long struggle that you and I, our grandparents, have been engaged in, and those before them. What we are doing is intensifying our struggles against this economic system and all other systems of oppression that are in partnership with this system called capitalism. One of the unfortunate things for us today, sisters and brothers, is that even among activists, we use euphemism for this system. We call it neoliberalism or neoliberal globalization. Interestingly, we don't call it imperialism, which it truly is, because we have also adopted our language to the expectation of the dominant system. I'm a trade unionist, a very proud QP member, but I don't just identify myself as a QP member. My larger identity is that of a member of the working class, and also as a student. I'm someone that used the knowledge and skills and the attitude of resistance that comes through my privileged access to post-secondary education to work for the working class and all other oppressed people. The focus of my contribution this morning, and I'm very thankful to the organizers for providing the opportunity for me to share some thoughts with you, and also to hear what are some of the ideas that you have in your mind and in confronting this economic system, and also to respond to the economic challenges that working class people are facing in their diversity, whether it's homeless or people, the wage slaves or the working poor or other people in the society. I'll be looking at labor self-management and the fight against economic exploitation. And by centering labor self-management, I'm looking at the possibilities. You know, what are the opportunities that are there for workers while in capitalism to organize an economic experiment that in reality becomes a center where we can challenge capitalism, you know, in its operation, where we can create economic spaces where workers can manage their economic affair and not be so satisfied with going to work and you making the decisions as workers, but we use these free spaces as areas from which to launch a larger economic and political struggle against capitalism, liberal democracy and all other forms of exploitation. First thing I'd like to say, maybe one among the first things, is when we talk about the attack on public services that's been going on since the 1970s, intensified in the 80s under Reaganomics, under Thatcherism, and even our own version of that under Mulroney and liberals and other administrations, provincially and federally since, is that this welfare system, this welfare structure that we have was a strategic bargain between organized labor and the capitalist class after World War II. And especially in the context where you had an alternative system, social and economic system in the form of the Soviet Union, the welfare system was developed as a way to tame revolutionary agitation inside Western Europe and also in North America, Japan, and other places where other developed countries where capitalism was very fearful of the alternative of that was taking place in the Soviet Union. And I'm not, you know, making or suggesting that bureaucratic form of socialism is desirable, but it was an alternative for workers in the West who were looking for a different form of system, a non-exploitive form of system for workers and citizens in general. But again, it being a bargain, it was a compromise between organized labor, trade unions, and the capitalists to come to some type of decision that you give us better wages, guaranteed jobs for you workers who are unionized, and we won't push and challenge capitalism. You provide, you know, welfare programs, whether it's healthcare, you know, whether it's unemployment benefits, and we will just moderate and tame out, you know, desire to seek a fundamental change in the system. Not only would organized labor do that, it would also terrorize those of us in the ranks of organized labor who wanted a genuine economic system. We wanted a real political democracy in society, and that has happened up even to in 2008. We removed a clause from a constitution of QP Ontario where, in effect, we wouldn't, even though it has been practiced for a long time, where communists, members of communist organization, would be allowed to serve on our executive board. That was just a product of the Cold War. But what's interesting is that even though we had a member of the Communist Party who was on the board, we didn't even realize that this clause was an anti-communist clause, and we recently got rid of it. And but you know, that in itself is symbolic, because that does mean that QP Ontario or any other work, you know, unions are committed to the type of struggle that would represent a critique and a break from this dominant economic system. Sisters and brothers, I see the long-term solution to poverty and economic exploitation led by activists, community organizers. I see the long-term solution to poverty and economic exploitation addressing the need to look at what is going on with this economic system. This system cannot produce the type of employment situation that we want, and it will never be able to provide economic security that we need. We can just look at what is going on in terms of wages. Who are the main beneficiaries of the fruits of collective labor? If we, in 2006 in the United States, the average, the wage gap between CEOs, the average CEOs and workers were like 242 times. In effect, that workers were earning above $42,000 while the average CEO was earning 242 times $42,000. In 2008 in Canada, we experienced a situation where the average worker was earning $42,300 here. But what we found is that compared to the salary of the average CEO, they were earning 172 times the average wage in Canada, with some the lowest CEO in that group earning like $2.3 million. What we found is that by the afternoon, by 1 p.m. on January the 1st in 2008, the top 100 CEOs had already earned $42,300. And yet we tolerate that. When that came out from the Center Policy Alternative earlier this year, we didn't march down to Queen's Park and burn that thing down, or march to Parliament Hill and burn it down for allowing such a travesty to take place. But I can assure you that if the government of Ontario should give $2,000 to a single person in social assistance, the citizens in this province would rise up, go to Queen's Park and burn it down for the folly that these MPPs have engaged in allowing poor people to earn $2,000 per month, which amounts only to $24,000 per year. And even that wouldn't be enough to provide a livable wage for poor people. What I'm suggesting is that even the members of the working class have accepted the normality of this gross income difference between working class people and the dominant economic actors. So we, you know, partially, this is also about consciousness, how we see ourselves as a people. Do we see ourselves as a member of one class, the working class, in terms of the majority of us? Unfortunately, that is not the case. What we have found in Canada is that even the trade unions, we are promoting this notion that we're largely a middle-class society. So if we're middle-class, class consciousness around our working relationship cannot be a basis on which we're going to mobilize, because if major trade union leaders on the provincial and the national level are saying that their primary objective is to increase the wages of the middle class and to increase economic security of the middle class, then who are these working people? who are these working class that they sometimes hypocritically talk about, especially when they're in the presence of radical trade unionists and they want to give the impression that they are really progressive and political. So, you know, we have a situation where, in spite of the fact that labor is the most important factor of production in the creation of wealth, we're experiencing a situation where labor is being pauperized, both in terms of the attack on universal social services and universal benefits that can at least increase our material life as poor people, as members of the working class. We're not in a situation where there's almost like this revulsion against the transfer of wealth to the dominant classes in this society. So, you know, how are, and one thing I should point to, is, and this comes in a framework of anti-oppression in terms of looking at how different systems of oppression intersect and also reinforce each other. When we look at the poverty rate in Canada, we may say, well, it's about 9% of Canadians nationally would be considered as poor. You know, maybe some people are saying that's not statistically significant. But then when you look at single women over 65, and then you see a poverty rate about 16 or 17%, or you look at single mothers and you see a poverty rate, you know, of almost 36%, or you look at women with disability and you see a poverty rate about 25 or 26%, you start to realize that there's some of us that are even are suffering more from poverty, and the general global statistics sometimes hide that reality. When we look at Aboriginal women, including Métis, you know, Inuits and First Nations, we see poverty rates of about 36% affecting women there. And, you know, the stats for men may be just a little bit better. But nonetheless, we, in our struggle for class solidarity, we also have to break down the demographics within that group called working class to see how others are suffering. And if we don't build solidarity with these groups within this broad working class configuration, we may not be able to mobilize that broad grouping that we need to mobilize. It means we have to challenge racism in our midst. It means that we have to challenge sexism in our midst. It means that we have to challenge homophobia in our midst, because all these groupings are part of this large class groupings called the working class or working people that some people will use. With racialized women, we see a poverty rate of about 28-29%. So we see there are some relevant factors that are out there that sometimes we lose because we want to create a sense of that we're all the same and we're unified, but there are differences within, and those differences should be a source of strength, not weaknesses, but we have to approach them in a principled way. I would say that even if we should eliminate poverty tomorrow, wow, even if we should eliminate poverty tomorrow, sisters and brothers, we still would have to, we still wouldn't have a just society for those of us who sell our labor. And it's for that reason that I'm proposing that as a positive way towards challenging capitalism, we need to start to look at organizing worker-owned firms, not as little islands of security for those who are part of it, but as part of the struggle to challenge capitalism. Every day we go to work, sisters and brothers, and the expectation that we have in this kind of pseudo-political democracy that you will be consulted, you will vote for the people who are supposed to make decisions on your behalf, and I say it's a farce. But even the economic realm, when we go to work, we have to check our independence and our creativity at the door and go in and be bullied, boss, regulated by the bosses and by capital. So what I'm proposing is for us to start to look at how can we create worker-owned enterprises as these sites of economic democracy, as these sites of workers showing that we, even to ourselves, not to the capitalists, but showing to ourselves that intelligence in production, management, directing, planning is not the preserve of bosses and preserve of economic elite. because without the brain and the muscles of workers, there cannot be any wealth. In capitalist economics, they will tell you that there are four factors of production: land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship, brothers and sisters, is labor. Capital is labor. Show me in nature where capital exists without labor putting itself into natural resources, and natural resources is a gift of nature. Putting itself, mixing up labor and natural resources to create something else. If we think about the tractor trailer, like, where's the tractor trailer in nature as a capital goods? It's our labor, our brain, and our brawn have to mix with the natural resources under the direction of labor to create these capital goods. So when the capitalists are talking about, well, capital must be given profit because, you know, it risks itself, you're really talking about labor that wasn't distributed back for consumption, that's been stored for further economic production. So we do not need a capitalist class. We do not need bosses, sisters and brothers. You and I can organize economic production, produce the needs that, you know, meet the needs that we have without being directed by the bosses. We need to start to think of what type of system can be created, even in the context of capitalism, as embryonic economic forms that will meet our needs. If we have a need for housing, how can workers organize in worker-owned enterprises to create homes? If we have the need for food, can't we as citizens organize worker-owned food cooperative or enterprises democratically run to you know, produce food, to provide food, where we're producing food not for the reasons of making profit, but to meet the needs that we have. This is not some type of utopic ideas, because you have worker-owned worker cooperatives in Canada, in other parts of the world. There are problems with them, but we can come up with a different approach that is not a way to adapt ourselves into this economic system, but it represents a departure from how labor is organized and how labor is really manifested in the workplace. In a question and answer period, you know, I would like to focus on some of the practical things, because I think I've used up more than my share of the time. And this is a large topic that I would be willing to speak on at length in a different context. But I think we have to start to think about building the road as we travel. And the economic realm is one of the most important part of our lives, and we need to reclaim it from the capitalists. We need to reclaim it from the state. But it's going to be a battle of will. And there are resources that exist in the state that we, through contestation, we can force them to finance the very system that's going to lead to their destruction. But it's going to lead means political mobilization, political education, and the willingness to work for long-term structural change in the context of this system. Thank you, sisters and brothers.